Welcome to Order Militaris Radio TV, and today's show is going to be something you have never heard before, because this man has been censored almost out of history. And we welcome our guest host today, Brother Alexis Bonello.
Thank you, AJ, for having me on, and it's wonderful. It's going to be asked to be the host for this program about Admiral Alexander Kolchak, one of the great Christian leaders of Russia in her last hours before she was taken over by the Bolsheviks. We're doing this as part of our series on Christian leadership. And Kolchak is an admirable figure, and you've seen his life immortalized in the film The Admiral, which you can find on the internet, dubbed in many languages. And but we're going to tell you something today more about him, his life, his career, the glorious things he achieved. Tragedies he suffered and his betrayal, and how he loved, remained faithful to that Christian patriotism. So let's begin. AJ, do you hear me?
Yeah, I do. And see you.
Okay. When was, where did it get cut off?
Right before you asked the question, I think.
Okay. So let's learn something more about this great man, Admiral Kolchak. When and where was he born?
Alexander Kolchak was born in St. Petersburg in 1874 to a family of minor Russian nobility of the Moldovan origin. His mother and father came from Odessa. His father was a retired Major General of the Marine Artillery.
Okay, so Moldavian, interesting. So what do we know about his education, and what do we know about the schools he attended?
Alexander was being groomed for a career in the Navy. He went to the Naval Cadet Corps and graduated 1894. The school is what we call a college, but schooling in Russia was different. There were different levels of school called gymnasiums for your primary education. Then after that, you would be sent to one of these academies if your future or your vocation was in the military. What gymnasiums he attended as a child, we don't know. Just a higher education at the Naval Cadet Corps. It is one of the oldest existing institutions of higher education in Russia, even to this very day.
And his father had taken part in the siege of Sevastopol in 1854. What was this about, and how did this shape his life?
His father took part in was a one-year battle from October 1854 to September 1855 during the Crimean War. The allies were was France, Sardinian, Ottoman, and the British, who landed their men at Eupatoria on 14 September. And their intent was to triumphantly march into Sevastopol, the capital of Crimea, with 50,000 men. To travel 35 miles, it took a year of fighting against the Russians. To travel 35 miles, it took 1 year. The famous battles, Alma, September 1854, Balaklava, October 1854, Inkerman, November 1854, Techenaya, August 1885, Redan, September 1855, and finally Malakhov, September 1855. Of course, the Crimea fell, but wasn't due to the lack of fighting. The Russians put up a great defense and sent numerous Allied soldiers to the grave. The cannons used by the Russians were sent back to Britain to their military colleges or museums. The big cannon, the Cassica Bell, was used to be melted down and turned into the Victoria Cross medals.
And his father participated in that campaign as a part of the Russian Navy or as a part of the Russian infantry?
Probably the, I would say since it's Marine artillery, probably.
Okay.
The Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He was
okay.
in charge of the cannons.
So after Kolchak graduates from the Naval Academy, he gets to know someone by the name of Edward Toll. And what adventure does this lead to?
Yeah. He goes on to the Russian Polar Expedition, which is... Their first and second navigations are quite interesting, but I'm just reading some of the dates they have here. Thankfully, Wikipedia sort of used their diaries here and put some of their diary things. The first navigation on the Russian Polar Expedition. On 8 June 1900, Zarya left St. Petersburg, heading for Kronstadt, the Gulf of Finland, where it had a minor problem. While it was being fixed in Tallinn, Toll left the ship, crossed the Gulf, and went by train to Oslo to consult with Nansen, and then Bergen to meet Zarya from Bergen to Tromsø. The ship was guided by a specially hired local pilot in Tromsø. While the crew was waiting for the coal resupply from England, it had two major incidents. The Malagin got arrested for a drunken brawl, whereas Samaskin contracted a venereal disease and was found unfit for his duties by Dr. Walter. The day after passing North Cape on 11th July 1900, Zarya approached Polar Army to replenish his coal supplies. There, Toll and Kolomintsev had its first major quarrel over their roles in the expedition, which ended the request of Kolomintsev to relieve him from his duties. Toll, in line with the spirit of the contemporary Russian, longed for comradeship and treated sailors as equals. Meanwhile, Kolomintsev, a classic naval officer of the Russian Imperial Navy, tried to keep a distance with the men and impose harsh punishments for unruly behavior of Malagin and Samaskin. Kolomintsev thought that Toll's attitude undermines his authority as commander of Zarya. After unsuccessful mediation attempts, Kolchak offered his resignation too, which partly quenched that conflict. As Toll could not afford losing two of his key assistants, next morning the expedition took on board 60 sled dogs and replaced Malagin and Samaskin with two mushers, Peter Stresov and Stefan Rastorgiv.
What made Kolchak return home after 2 years on this expedition?
Well, first, it was this brutal cold, about 40 degrees below Celsius. And he also had to go back and get help, go find Edward von Toll and his other friends on this trip.
And what do we know happened to Edward von Toll and the rest of the crew?
So where they left off and the rest of the team evacuated so that Kolchak and his others could try to go get help. Told made this decision to go south from there to the continent. And that is where it writes, no further traces of the four men have ever been found.
Did Kolchak go on his own two personal Arctic expeditions, and where did he go, and how did he merit the name Kolchak Polyarmy?
Yeah, he went to the Bering Strait in Cape Desnev, and he commanded the ship which he helped to design and build, the Vikak. It is during this and during this his other expedition to look for his friends, he was given the name Kolchak Polyarmy, or Kolchak the Polar.
Now let's get something into his personal life. Who was his wife, Sofia Omirova, and when did they get married?
As they would say down south in all the Bible Belt, they had a shotgun wedding real quick. But it was not as hot down in the south, because he had to send out a telegram hastily to his wife-to-be and her father to get to Siberia before he went to the Russo-Japanese War. And so on December 1903, they were hastily married and had a little time for to consummate the marriage, and then off he goes to war.
So, tell us about Kolchak and where he reported for duty in the Russo-Japanese War.
Let's see here. The Japanese-Russian War, fought during the 1904 and 1905 between the Russian Empire in the Empire of Japan over the rival imperial ambitions in Manchuria and Korea. The major theaters of operation were the Liaodong Peninsula in the Mukden in southern Manchuria and the seas around Korea, Japan in the Yellow Sea. Russia sought a warm water port on the Pacific Ocean for its navy and for maritime trade. Vladivostok was operational only during the summer, whereas Port Arthur, a naval base in Liaodong province leased to Russia by the Qing Dynasty of China, was operational all year. Since the end of the First Sino-Japanese War in 1895, Japan feared Russia encroachment on its plans to create a sphere of influence in Korea and Manchuria. Russia had demonstrated an expansionist policy in Siberian Far East from the reign of Ivan the Terrible in the 16th century. Seeing Russia as a rival, Japan offered to recognize Russian dominance in Manchuria in exchange for recognition of Korea as being within the Japanese sphere of influence. Russia refused and demanded Korea north of the 39th parallel to be a neutral buffer zone between Russia and Japan. The Japanese government perceived Russia as a threat to their plans of expansion into Asia and chose to go to war. After negotiations broke down in 1904, the Japanese Navy opened hostilities by attacking the Russian Eastern Fleet at Port Arthur, China, in a surprise attack. Russia suffered multiple defeats by Japan, but Tsar Nicholas II was convinced that Russia would win and chose to remain engaged in the war, at first to wait the outcomes of certain naval battles, and later to preserve the dignity of Russia by averting a humiliating peace. Russia ignored Japan's willingness early on to agree to an armistice and rejected the idea of bringing the dispute to the arbitration court at the Hague. The war concluded with the Treaty of Portsmouth, mediated by U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt. The complete victory of the Japanese military surprised the world observers. The consequences transformed the balance of power in East Asia, resulting in a reassessment of Japan's recent entry onto the world stage. It was the first major military victory in the modern era of an Asian power over a European one. Scholars continue to debate the historical significance of the war.
How was Admiral Kolchak's service in the war, and how many ships did the Russian Navy Imperial Fleet lose?
In the early stages of the Russo-Japanese War, he served as watch officer on the cruiser Askold, later commanded the destroyer Sureti. He made several night sorties to lay naval mines, one of which succeeded in sinking the Japanese cruiser Takasago. He was decorated with the Order of St. Anna, 4th class, for the exploit. As the blockade of the port tightened and the siege of Port Arthur intensified, he was given command of the Coastal Artillery Battery. He was wounded in the final battle of Port Arthur and taken as prisoner of war to Nagasaki, where he spent 4 months. His poor health, rheumatism, and a consequence of his polar expeditions led to his reparation before the end of the war. Kolchak was awarded the Golden Sword of St. George with the inscription for bravery on his return to Russia. They lost most of their ships, and it was Kolchak who would be put in charge to rebuild the Russian Navy.
Yeah, it was a military debacle. I think the Japanese sunk the entire Russian Eastern Fleet in like 15 minutes because they had modern ships. So now Kolchak is put in charge of rebuilding the Russian Navy. How did he help do this? And why did he create the special icebreaker ships for which the Russian Navy became famous?
When he returned to St. Petersburg in April 1905, Kolchak was promoted to lieutenant commander and took part in rebuilding of the Imperial Russian Navy, which had been almost completely destroyed in the war. He served on the Naval General Staff from 1906, helping draft a shipbuilding program, a training program, and developing a new protection plan for St. Petersburg in the Gulf of Finland. And his two, the icebreakers would help him in his next expedition, where he'll write two books on it, and they'll be even published by the American Geological Society.
So tell us about these expeditions and his two books about them that he went on before the First World War broke out.
Kolchak commanded the Vykosh during this expedition and later worked at the Academy of Sciences. With the material collected by him during expeditions, his study, the ices of the Kara in the Siberian Seas, was printed in the proceedings of the Russian Imperial Academy of Sciences and is considered the most important work on the subject. Extracts from it were published under the title The Arctic Back Napoleonia in the volume issued in 1929 by the American Geographical Society. Problems of Polar Research, Siberian Seas was printed in the proceedings of the Russian Imperial Academy of Sciences and is considered the most important work on this subject. Extracts from it were published under the title The Arctic Back Napoleonia in the volume issued in 1929 by the American Geographical Society's Problems of the Polar Research. So pretty important work to understand how the weather and everything is in that region.
Okay, so then the First World War breaks out, as we know that Prussia and Russia attacked Austria because of Austria's attack on Serbia. And the First World War opens up, and where does Kolchak find himself in this conflict?
Well, the first is on the flagship Pogranichnik. Rakolchak oversaw the laying of extensive coastal defenses, minefields, and commanded the naval forces in the Gulf of Riga. Commanding Admiral Essen was not satisfied to remain on the defensive and ordered Kolchak to prepare a scheme for attacking the approaches of the German naval bases. During the autumn and winter of 1914 and 1915, the Russian destroyers and cruisers started a series of dangerous night operations, laying mines at the approaches to Kiel and Danzig. Kolchak, feeling that the men responsible for planning operations should also take part in their execution, was always on board those ships which carried out the operations and at times took direct command of destroyer flotillas. He was also promoted vice admiral in August 1916, the youngest man at that rank, and was made commander of the Black Sea Fleet, replacing Admiral Eberhardt. Kolchak's primary mission was to support General Yudenich in his operation against the Ottoman Empire. He also was tasked with countering the U-boat threat and planning the invasion of the Bosphorus, which was never carried out. Kolchak's fleet was successful at sinking Turkish colliers because there was no railroad linking the coal mine to eastern Turkey with Constantinople. The Russian fleet attacked on these Turkish coal ships caused the Ottoman government much hardship. In 1916, in combined Army-Navy assault, the Russian Black Sea Fleet aided the Russian Army's capture of the Ottoman city of Trebizonde.
How is it that it comes to be that the Imperial Dreadnought Maria explodes in port, and do we know who did it, and what fault was put on the shoulders of Kolchak for this?
Well, since he was the commander of the entire fleet, they were all at port, you know, just at port. So, like, it's on you. You're the commander. But the forward powder magazine, while at anchor in Sevastopol, but exploded before any efforts could be made to fight the fire. Sailors led by engineer mechanic midshipman Ignatiev, however, managed to flood the forward shell magazine before the explosion at the cost of their own lives. Their action probably prevented a catastrophic detonation, and all other magazines were flooded as a precaution. About 40 minutes after the first explosion, a second occurred in the vicinity of the torpedo compartment that destroyed the watertight integrity of the rest of the forward bulkheads. The Imperatrista Maria began to sink by the bow and listed to starboard. She capsized a few minutes later, taking 228 sailors with her. The subsequent investigation determined that the explosion was probably the result of a spontaneous combustion of nitrocellulose based propellant as it decomposed.
What? So was he removed from his position as commander on account of this tragedy?
No. Well, not because of that, but because of the revolution.
So now, most people don't know, so the war between Prussia and Austria and Russia in the First World War did not go well for the Russians. The Germans and Austrians end up capturing most of the Ukraine, and then this revolution breaks out we're talking about February of 1917. This is the first revolution.
Yeah. The entire Black Sea Fleet descended into political chaos after the onset of the 1917 February Revolution. Kolchak was relieved of command of the fleet in June and traveled to Petrograd or St. Petersburg. On his arrival at Petrograd, Kolchak was invited to a meeting of the provincial government. There he presented his views on the condition of the Russian armed forces and to complete the demoralization. He stated that the only way to save the country was to reestablish strict discipline and restore capital punishment in the army and navy. During this time, many organizations and newspapers of a conservative inclination spoke of him as a future dictator. A number of new and secret organizations had sprung up in Petrograd with the goal of suppressing the Bolshevik movement and the removal of the extremist members of the government. Some of these organizations asked Kolchak to accept the leadership. When the news of these plots found their way to them, to then naval minister of the provincial government, Alexander Kerensky, he ordered Kolchak to leave immediately for America. Admiral James H. Glennon, a member of the American mission headed by Senator Elihu Root, invited Kolchak to the United States to brief the American Navy on the strategic situation in the Bosphorus. On 19 August 1917, Kolchak with several officers left Petrograd for Britain, in the United States as a quasi-official military observer. When passing through London, he was greeted cordially by the First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir John Jellicoe, who offered him transport on the board of a British cruiser on his way to Halifax in Canada. The journey to America proved unnecessary, as by the time Kolchak arrived, the U.S. had given up the idea of any independent action in the Dardanelles. Kolchak visited the American fleet in its ports and decided to return to Russia via Japan. So let me ask you, what is the Russian Civil War?
So the civil war that breaks out in Russia is between the Bolsheviks, who attempt to overthrow the Christian order, and all the other anti-Tsarist forces, because the revolution was not begun by the Bolsheviks. It was begun by those opposed to the rule by the Tsar. But the Bolsheviks had worked for years to undermine loyalty in the military. And Lenin was already in Russia now because Bismarck allowed him to pass through Germany from Switzerland. So the Russian Civil War we're going to talk about now is the Bolsheviks, the war between the Reds, that's the Bolsheviks, and the Whites, which were the non-Marxists who wanted to preserve Russia as a Christian nation, but weren't really in favor of restoring the Tsar either, though some of them were. So that's what the Russian Civil War is. So on one side, we're highly organized, that's the Bolsheviks, and they have an ideology and a purpose. And the other side is highly unorganized with different motivations and loyalties. Now, in the movie, it shows Kolchak kissing this, being dared to kiss the first woman who comes through the door. And who is this? Did you track down this little historical note and find out who she was?
Not really, but from our discussion to set up this show, you said how improper it would have been back then to do anything like that. So I wasn't sure if I should have tracked down that, because I wasn't sure if it was true or not.
Sometimes they put these things in the films and it's not true. Okay. So why did Kolchak want to join the British Army, and why did they send him back to Russia?
Upon hearing the October Revolution, Kolchak offered to enlist in the British Army to continue the struggle. The British were inclined to accept Kolchak's offer, and there were indeed plans to send Kolchak to Mesopotamia. Ultimately, the British Foreign Office decided that Kolchak could do more for the Allied cause by toppling Vladimir Lenin and the Bolsheviks and bringing Russia back into the war on the side of the Allies. Reluctantly, Kolchak accepted the British suggestion. and returned to Russia.
So on his return to Russia, what are the things that lead up to him becoming the supreme leader of Russia?
When he arrived in Manchuria, he was placed in charge of security for the Russian-owned Chinese Eastern Railroad. And arriving in Omsk, Siberia, he en route to enlisting the volunteer army. He agreed to become the minister in the White Siberian Regional Government, joining a 14-man cabinet. He was a prestige figure the government hoped to play on the respect he had with the Allies, especially the head of the British military mission, General Alfred Knox. Knox wrote that Kolchak had more grit, pluck, and honest patriotism than any Russian in Siberia. In November 1918, the unpopular regional government was overthrown in a British-sponsored coup d'etat. Kolchak had returned to Omsk on 16th of November from an inspection tour. He was approached and refused to take power. The Socialist Revolutionary, the SR, directory leader and members, were arrested on 18th November by a troop of Cossacks under Ataman Kasparyan Krasnoyarkov. The remaining cabinet members met and voted for Kolchak to become the head of the government with emerging powers. He was named supreme ruler and promoted himself to full admiral. The rest of the SR politicians were expelled from Siberia and ended up in Europe. Let me read his manifesto.
So he issues this manifesto after he becomes supreme leader.
Yeah.
And this is going to explain what his motives are. So let's hear it.
The provisional all-Russian government has come to an end. The Council of Ministers, having all power in its hands, has invested me, Admiral Alexander Kolchak, with this power. I have accepted this responsibility in exceptionally difficult circumstances of civil war and complete disorganization of the country. And I now make it known that I shall follow neither the reactionary path nor the deadly path of party strife. My chief aims are the organization of a fighting force, the overthrow of Bolshevism, the establishment of law and order, so that Russian people may be able to choose a form of government in accordance with its desires and realize the high ideas. And the pages stick together, of course. Of liberty and freedom, I call upon you, citizens, to unite and to sacrifice your all, if necessary, in the struggle with Bolshevism.
Okay, so he was a determined anti-communist to his eternal credit. Now, who were the Allied powers who allegedly were supporting Kolchak?
Britain, France, America, Czechoslovakia, region.
And how successful was Kolchak's army? I mean, after all, he was an admiral, and now he's commanding troops on land. So,
yeah. At the start, when they had full backing and military and support of the Allies, they were very successful, where they almost took back Moscow.
But why did the Allied powers end up pulling support from him?
On 26 May 1919, the Supreme Allied Council in Paris offered to provide Kolchak with unlimited supplies of food, weapons, munitions, and other supplies, but not diplomatic recognition, provided that he was willing to meet the following conditions. First one, promise to convene the Constituent Assembly of the Bolsheviks had disbanded in January 1918. allow local self-government and territories under his control, promised not to restore the aristocrats the former land system, and make no attempt to reintroduce the regime which the revolution had destroyed, i.e. not restore the monarchy, recognize the independence of Finland and Poland, accept Allied mediation for relations with the Baltic states and in the Caucasus, promise to join the League of Nations, promise to pay all of Russia's debts. Kolchak with French General Maurice Jehan. Pipes wrote, though the Allies wanted the Constituent Assembly to decide the future of Russia, but they had decided in advance in their conditions that they had imposed such no restoration of the monarchy, many matters that properly should have been decided by the Constituent Assembly. As Kolchak was entirely dependent upon supplies of Britain, as British shipped him in the period of October 1918 and October 19, about 600,000 rifles, 6,831 machine guns, about 200,000 uniforms, he had to accept nearly all the conditions. In a telegram to Paris sent on 4th June 1919, Kolchak accepted every condition except for the independence of Finland, which he accepted only de facto, not de jure, saying he wanted the Constituent Assembly to grant Finland its independence. The British War Secretary, Winston Churchill, pressed very strongly in the cabinet for British recognition of Kolchak's government, but the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, would only do so if the United States likewise recognized Kolchak. The American President, Woodrow Wilson, was strongly hostile towards Kolchak, openly doubted his word, and was against diplomatic recognition. Wilson's main advisor on Russia was the former head of the provisional government, Alexander Kerensky, who told Wilson that Kolchak was a reactionary who would inaugurate a regime hardly less sanguinary and repressive than that of the Bolsheviks. So Bolshevik advised Wilson.
That's not surprising. Wilson destroyed Europe after the First World War by so many of the decisions he made, like backstabbing the Greeks and the Armenians. He was a Freemason of the highest level. So who did President Wilson send to Russia, and what was their role and in all of this?
Yeah. Though American forces in Siberia cooperated with Kolchak, it was clear he was not the man favored by the United States as the next leader of Russia. American forces had been sent to Siberia less to help the whites than to prevent the Japanese who had occupied the Russian Far East from annexing it, as Tokyo was openly considering. U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's claimed objectives for sending troops to Siberia were as much diplomatic as they were military. One major reason was to rescue the 40,000 men of the Czechoslovak Legion who were being held up by Bolshevik forces as they attempted to make their way along the Trans-Siberian Railroad to Vladivostok, and it was hoped eventually to the Western Front. Another major reason was to protect the large quantities of military supplies and railroad rolling stock that the United States had sent to the Russian Far East in support of the Russian Empire's war efforts on the Eastern Front of World War I. Equally stressed by Wilson was the need to study any efforts at self-government or self-defense in which the Russians themselves may be willing to accept assistance. At the time, Bolshevik forces in Siberia controlled only small pockets, and President Wilson wanted to make sure that neither Cossack marauders nor the Japanese military would take advantage of the unstable political environment, along with the strategic railroad line and the resource-rich Siberian regions that straddle it. Anti-communism was also a strong factor. General Graves believed their mission was to provide protection for American supplied property and to help Czechoslovak Legion evacuate Russia, and that it did not include fighting against the Bolsheviks. Repeatedly calling for restraint, Graves often clashed with commanders of Britain, French, and Japanese forces, who also had troops in the region and who wanted him to take more effective part in the military intervention in Siberia.
And I should point out that the Czech Legion began by fighting with the Bolsheviks, then switched sides to the Whites. But it's interesting to see how Wilson, who was a Freemason and who stabbed so many people in the back, wants to save the Czech Legion, but not Russia. And we will see that America will pay dearly for these mistakes of Wilson for the next century. So when does Kolchak begin to be betrayed by those around him?
It was around this time when President Wilson would not support Kolchak because of the lies about him, he was told. Then the Czech Legion, the American force was to protect, was also making deals with the communists to hand Kolchak over.
And why did the Czech Legion hand Kolchak over?
As you said, they first started with the Bolsheviks, then got protection with the Freemason Wilson, then again another deal with the Bolsheviks, right?
What, wasn't Kolchak also in possession with a huge treasury, and the Czechs, if I remember correctly, handed them over in exchange for that money?
Mm-hmm.
So, when was Kolchak martyred? And speak of how brave he was in his final hours. Moments of life.
Both prisoners, Admiral Alexander Kolchak, Prime Minister Viktor Pepelyayev, brought before a firing squad in early morning of 7 February 1920, according to eyewitnesses. Kolchak was entirely calm and unafraid. Like an Englishman, the Admiral asked the commander of the firing squad, "Would you be so good to get a message sent to my wife in Paris to say that I blessed my son?" The commander responded, "I'll see what can be done if I don't forget about it." A priest of the Russian Orthodox Church then gave the last rites to both men. The squad fired and both men fell. The bodies were kicked and prodded down an escarpment and dumped under the ice of the frozen Inga River. Bodies were never recovered. Now that part of the river is where, on the Epiphany, they jump into the lake that's shaped in the cross. And they're still there. Brother Alexis, you there? He's not there. So I just finished saying how they were martyred and where that river, what that river is used for in the Epiphany.
Okay. Now, did you watch the movie The Admiral?
Three times.
Three times? Okay. I watched it only, I think, once and a half. And I watched it in the Russian with the subtitles. And what would you say about the movie?
It was good. It was like a traditional Russian film. A lot of twists and turns, a lot of sorrow, a lot of suspense. And a lot of heartbreak.
I thought it was very well done, very historically accurate. About the only difficulty I have is I didn't know the chronology of Admiral Kolchak's life or much about him. Now that we've done this program, if you go and watch the movie The Admiral, which you can find on the internet for free, in subbed in English, or subtitled in English, that is. It's an excellent film, and I think this movie teaches us a lot about today. The whole world is under an organized Marxist attack, and everyone who's opposed to it is separated individual. We're all in little pockets. And they're going to do the same thing to us. They're going to pick us off one by one and stab us in the back and betray us. And they're going to try to flip our most closest allies to turn against us. And this is what they're up to. And Kolchak is a good example of how we need to, with our Christian faith, remain loyal to morality, to Christ, to true patriotism, but to also, from his failures, how we should be mistrustful of any Masonic help. We have to understand the governments of the world are Masonic, and most political parties are ruled by the Masons. Mm-hmm. In the United States, both parties, the Republican, the Democrat, are Masonic parties. A lot of people won't admit that. And if you have a good friend that's loyal to one of the two parties, he will betray you when the time comes, because his religion is the Masonic Lodge, though he won't come out and say it. And I've seen Catholics just in these last 6 months flip from 100% Catholic to 100% demonic over the slightest little thing. You just say their man is not out to make America great again, and they'll turn on you. They're the kind of people who pick up the phone and call and give your name and address so that you get hauled away and shot, because they have no morality left. Their whole heart is completely emptied from Christ. And you cannot be too careful. So you have to really whittle down your list of friends, because a lot of people are going to apostatize, and we might be in the final tribulation spoken of in the apocalypse. But Admiral Kolchak shows how we should fight to the end and be brave about it, and don't give up the fight, and do what we can to organize. If we have any sense of leadership or any influence, we should organize our defense. Mm-hmm. However necessary that is, whether it's merely political or whether it's even military.
Yeah. I really wanted to see if there was any books about him. There's not. Not even his science books are being sold. Why is that?
I think, you know, I'll be a bit critical here. If in English we don't know anything about him, it must be because we stabbed him in the back. Yeah. You notice that agreement that will give you all the supplies necessary as long as you don't restore the monarchy. That is so Masonic. Because why are the Western countries that claim to be democratic telling Kolchak not to allow the people to vote whether they're going to have a monarchy restored or not? Okay. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want a Christian government in Russia. That was the reason. And they pulled support from Kolchak because they feared he would upset their Masonic plans. The Bolsheviks were being funded by the Freemasons out of New York City, and been given vast amounts of finances to do it. So what the West was doing in supporting the whites was merely to maintain their image as Christians and conservatives, when in fact they wanted the Bolsheviks to win all along, because what they really want is the destruction of Christ's kingdom on earth. And that requires a destruction of a Christian Russia. And this is why in the very same years they're plotting for the destruction of Russia, Our Lady is coming to Fatima and promising the conversion of Russia and the restoration of Russia. And this is where Catholics' loyalty should truly be, for the conversion of Russia and the restoration of a Christian nation of Russia, as well as anywhere else. So if you're Catholic and you're in favor of anyone from a Masonic party, then you're betraying Our Lady of Fatima and you're not really loyal to Christ. You should stop fooling yourself. You're an agent of Satan and you're in league with the Antichrist. Just admit it, okay? Be frank about it. Don't spout Catholic doctrine 2711 and then tell people to obey a Freemason. Okay. So be sincere about it and let people know what side you really stand on. So recently, however, after the movie was made, they discovered an archive of his original papers. When, where did this happen, and how did they end up back in Russia?
Yeah. This was reported on from the Siberian Times, February 12th, 2020. A group of Russian billionaires spent over 3 million euro at a French auction to buy historic papers of the man who tried to restore and save Russia. A collection of Alexander Kolchak's manuscripts, a handwritten 1918 proclamation of his provincial all-Russian government, declaring intention to bring united and reborn Russia into the circle of the great democracies of the world, unseen pictures of himself and family, and loving private letters to his wife and son, written mostly in 1919, were kept for over 90 years inside a foreign bank vault. No one knew about the collection, or rather a few close relatives did know that it existed, but they didn't realize what it comprised, said Anastasia Beer, a Paris-based specialist on Russian archives, who was asked to view the files in spring 2019.
I find it's ironic. It appears that these very files were kept in a French vault of a bank, even while the Germans had captured it in 41. Some 20 years later, no one knew they were there. Yeah. So now these files are back in Russia, and do you know where they've been moved to? What institute it houses them?
No, but I could read a letter of his that he wrote in English. His wife. From Admiral Kolchak in Omsk to Madame Kolchak in Sevastopol, I am in good health. Have assumed temporary leadership of Russian armies fighting Bolsheviks in Siberia and Eastern Russia. In view of my present position and activities, I consider your stay in Russia dangerous. Therefore, I am requesting British government to arrange for your departure together with my son for England or France, will provide necessary means. The heartiest regards. I have deposited sum of 10,000 rubles with British consul in Vladivostok for your use. This money is being transferred at once to Foreign Office, London.
10,000 rubles was about $2,000 back then, so that's a fair amount of money to buy a house with that back in 1917, more than a house. Yeah. So
let's see where it's at. Let's see.
How is Admiral Kolchak the kind of leader that Russia or even any Christian nation needs today? In your opinion, AJ?
He was one who loves Russia. He risked everything. He was told to leave. I don't think he really wanted to leave. And he was truly devoted to the Tsar, as the Tsar gave him, I believe, a prophetic action in giving him the icon of the prophet Job to symbolize what he was going to go through. Exactly what Job went through, and losing everything. But he remained faithful. Died a faithful Christian, made it his duty to try to restore and save Russia for the church. And we don't see that today. We need a leader that would not be tied down to any Masonic bank, government, whatever. You're just faithful to Christ, do it, and faithful to their country, to restore the Christian country of their birth.
I totally agree. This is what we lack in the modern world, Christian leaders and Christian parties. And so many persons who feign to be true Christians or true Catholics, though loyalty is entirely for the Masonic system and they won't break from it. I had to laugh last month to read an article in the leading Catholic trad publication claiming that the entire scamdemic was merely to get Trump out of office. I mean, they don't see it. They won't admit it. It's obvious out there. Trump was an active agent in promoting the scandemic in the United States. He has Fauci next to him every day telling people the scandemic's true, and he never removed the guy. Mm-hmm. The governor shut down the states, and he never stopped it. He even said he'd pass out the vaccine with the military and that you should wear a mask. And they're trying to pretend that the scandemic is against Trump. I don't know what they're smoking. It must be marijuana because they're out of touch with reality. And that's a trad paper who's given up their entire loyalty to the Republican Party. They're no longer loyal to Jesus Christ. Another very prominent Catholic traditional lawyer, his recent article about opposing the scamdemic is all political. There's a mention of Jesus Christ at all in it. I mean, it's like he's become an atheist. And we can praise people who are opposing the scamdemic. We can. But you're not going to save your soul because you exposed the pandemic. You have to do what you do for the love of Jesus Christ, and you have to be in the state of grace and have the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could be like David Icke, and you're an excellent opponent of the scamdemic, but you're not even Christian. You're not going to merit eternal salvation from it. Let's not fall into the error of some writers of the 20th century that as long as you stand for any truth, you'll save your soul. No, that's pantheism. God alone is truth. There are created truths, and we should be loyal to them as Christians. But your loyalty to a created truth isn't going to save your soul if you're not Christian, or if you don't do it out of the love of the eternal truth, who's God and Jesus Christ, and you recognize it's Jesus Christ. So many people have fallen away in this scandemic from truth and reality, and it's exposed how almost the entire social order, academic institutions, ecclesiastic institutions and mass media, even in the Catholic world, have completely apostatized and gone over to the spirit of the Antichrist. And there's very, very few now, very few voices that are remaining faithful to Christ. There are people who say, I want my Latin Mass, and I don't care how many boys and girls are raped by the priest who say it. I mean, that's just pathological. If you say that, you're a Nazi. Okay. I don't care who you are or what your reputation is. So I praise people who are going to point out the errors of pedophiles and pedophile societies. I don't agree with everything Mike Bohr says, certainly not. But he spoke for the defense of children, and maybe he's a bit excessive in some of the language he uses. But we can't ignore that there are victims, and the people who protected victims are psychopaths. Mm-hmm. That society should be disassembled because, as Anthony Marie Claret says, and he's a saint, when a seminary gets corrupted by pedophilia and homosexuality, you have to dismiss all the instructors and never ever let them back into a seminary again, because they'll just renew the conspiracy, even the seminarians. So if that's true of a seminary, how much more it's true of a religious order. And Pius XII, trad's all praise, he suppressed 3 provinces of Jesuits just for this reason, okay? So if he suppressed the province of Jesuits, any institute that gets involved in pedophilia should be suppressed. And that means most of the dioceses around the world and nearly all the religious institutes should be suppressed, because they're run by psychopaths who believe that a pedophile can keep raping boys and girls as long as we have the mass and the money keeps coming in. That's psychopathy, okay? And no one can tolerate that. And we can't tolerate that our political leaders destroy our economies for a virus that's not even a threat of a winter cold. That is psychopathy. We cannot tolerate clergy who will put a mask over their face and deny the resurrection because of a virus that doesn't exist simply because a political leader says it. That is apostasy, okay? And we have to admit things are what they are. And I know a lot of you are devoted to receiving the Blessed Sacrament daily or weekly. But a devotional reception of the sacrament is no excuse for going to Mass with a heretic or apostate, okay? You're only required to receive communion once in your lifetime in the state of grace, right? You're not required to receive it every day of your life or every Sunday. That's not a requirement. So don't commit apostasy or sacrilege or live a lie, which is a mortal sin. Just receive Eucharist. Our Lord wouldn't want you to embrace him under those conditions. Okay, so just like he wouldn't accept an embrace in Herod's palace. So we have to remain faithful to Christ, to the truth, and to our religion. And we can't excuse the open, patent, manifest, public responsibility of the people who are failing in this scamdemic and who are pushing lies. You can't just claim some kind of fantastic theory about medicine and make a law on that basis. Law must be based on fact, on reality, and true medical science. Social distancing was a concept invented by a kid at a high school science fair. You cannot establish a law on such an opinion. And if you think you can, you're a psychopath. And if you think your leaders can, you are an acquired psychopath because you have decided you're going to obey a psychopath. And who is the psychopath of all psychopaths? It's Lucifer. Okay, so this is the religion of the Antichrist. You cannot obey a psychopath. And we've been indoctrinated in this a long time. When the Supreme Court said abortion is okay, that's psychopathy. And to accept the authority of the Supreme Court after Roe versus Wade is acquired psychopathy, because you're saying men who can decide that it's okay to kill a baby have the right to tell me anything else. They certainly don't. And then when they say gay marriage is okay or there's that right, that's psychopathy. So we have been slowly inducted into a society of the Antichrist over the last 50 years. And we need to start saying it openly, okay? And it's not just our political leaders, it's also in the church. When they found out all these scandals about raping boys back in the year 2000, and they appointed McCarrick, who was the rapist of rapists, to be the person in charge of reforming the church in the United States on this matter, that's psychopathy. So the bishops are psychopaths. That's why they tolerate Bergoglio, who clearly has no faith, is an apostate and a heretic, and they think there's nothing wrong that he celebrates, you know, diabolic rituals in the Vatican. If your bishop is naming Bergoglio in the canon of the Mass, he is a psychopath because he's saying truth has nothing to do with a religion, and that's not the Catholic faith. The Catholic faith is based on truth, so much so that there are saints who wouldn't even talk to others because other persons because they're heretics. St. Francis would not talk to a single friar of his order if he was a heretic. He'd lock him up on bread and water until he repented. He wouldn't even speak with them. So if you're willing to vote for these people or give them money, you have to understand you're involved in grave sin, grave mortal sin. You're not in communion with Jesus Christ, and you won't save your soul in this tribulation. So Kolchak shows us a man who would never compromise. He never compromised with the Bolsheviks. He was not going to allow them to take his country. He warred against them because they denied God, and he, above all, was a servant of the Most Holy Trinity, the true God. And he was faithful in the faith he had received from the apostles. He wasn't Roman Catholic, so we can't praise him in anything, but I can't say whether he knew the Catholic Church's claims to be true or not. But he gives us an example from that aspect of his life. And as Catholics, we should admit that and see that. So he is an example for our time, and he died 100 years ago. And 6 months ago, the 7th of August would be 100 years and 6 months from his death. And we need leaders like that today. And we have to stop the falsehood and the delusion that a Mason is going to save us, that a Freemasonic party is going to save us, or a Freemasonic nation or constitution is the way to order society. We have to break completely from that idea and establish a Catholic state, a Catholic party, Catholic politics with no compromise. And if you're the kind of Catholic who doesn't believe that's going to exist, then you do not have the Catholic faith. You do not believe God is omnipotent, and you don't believe God is the truth that will back everyone who wars and crusades for the truth. And just admit it. Don't stop pretending that you're a trad or that you're Catholic or that you're faithful or conservative. You're not. Okay? Just stop with the fakery, okay? And stop believing these fakers. I mean, tell you, the number of talking heads on the internet that are fakers is like 99%. You are being deceived by these people, okay? There are very few telling the truth. There are groups of people who are trying to push Fabian socialism, claiming they're promoting distributism. Don't believe them, okay? It's just the left trying to infiltrate by another path. So be on your guard. Hold fast to Christ. If you're loyal to Christ, you'll receive the grace of the sacraments, even if you don't have the sacraments, because it's communion with God that is the source of grace. It isn't the sacraments, okay? The sacraments are a useful instrument, and in normal times, they are necessary. But in extraordinary times, God will give you grace for remaining faithful to him, even without the sacraments, if you can't find faithful clergy anymore, which is true for most of us now.
Yeah. And before we close, if you're a faithful Russian Christian, and I don't know how it is over there, if you can go to libraries like here and do research, but a book on Kolchak needs to be written. And I would love to do it. But as you heard, there's not much I can find about him here. So comment on our YouTube channel or go to our website and leave a comment at ordo-militaris.net and share any information you can share, as his story needs to be fully more told, more than what a couple of articles on the world history, heritage organization, and Wikipedia has. He's a true hero even today, because we're still fighting the Bolsheviks who are now Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and now the Democrat Party.
Well, thank you, AJ, for asking me to be the guest host in this program. It was a wonderful program. I've learned things that I have never heard anywhere else. And I thank you for the research you've done for this program and for all the listeners of Ordo Militaris Radio TV.
Yeah. Tomorrow, as at our live stream time, 10:45, when we start getting things all lined up and link shared and everything shared, we'll be doing a live stream once again for Lebanon, an aid appeal for Lebanon. So those in Italian don't misunderstand what we're doing. Never heard of Jerry Lewis? He had a telethon for cancer victims. You're stupid or something?
In Italy, the word telethon has a bad name to it because there have been a lot of fraudsters on it. And people have to understand that in English, words mean different things.
Yeah.
You can't translate them. So yeah, we'll be doing a live fundraiser, a telethon, in a good sense of the word. And if you think it means something bad, then please don't listen and don't troll our publicity, because then you're responsible before God, okay? And this is for all the Catholic victims of Beirut, and this is to help them, humanitarian aid.
Yeah, looks like there is another explosion on the Lebanese-Israeli border. Hope everybody's okay there. Haven't heard anything new from our reporter there, Dwayne Jude Silva. So if there's anything else, we'll tell you about it tomorrow during our show for Lebanon. And we start going live about 10:45. And we start getting all the links and live stream videos put out on the website and everywhere. So tune in tomorrow. And Ordo Militaris Radio, sign off. Deus vult.
Deus vult.